The mud had reached my knees before I fully understood the situation I was in. It had started so reasonably. Or at least, that's what I kept telling myself as the creek bank swallowed my left boot with a sound that could only be described as gleefully triumphant. A wet, deep slurp that echoed through the quiet morning forest like the land itself was laughing at me. Which, fair enough. I probably deserved it. I'd been chasing the goat. Bram, named after my father's oldest friend, and equally stubborn, had escaped the pen again just before dawn, and I'd tracked him through the eastern woods for the better part of an hour, following the trail of chewed bark and general destruction he left in his wake. When I'd finally spotted him standing at the edge of Sallow Creek, drinking calmly like he hadn't just cost me my entire morning, I'd made the critical error of assuming the bank was solid. It was not solid. The first step had been fine. The second had been suspicious. By the third, the earth had made its intentions very clear, and now I was planted to my knees in cold black mud that smelled faintly of pine sap and something older, something deep and loamy, and entirely indifferent to my dignity. Bram watched me from 3 feet away, still chewing. "Don't," I told him. He blinked. I pulled my right leg. "Nothing." I pulled harder. The mud responded by tightening. I felt it close around my calf like a slow, deliberate hand, and the absurdity of the whole situation hit me so completely and suddenly that I stopped fighting and just laughed. It started small, just a breath through my nose. But then I looked at Bram's expression, that flat, ancient, deeply unimpressed goat face, and it turned into something real. A full, helpless laugh that bent me forward at the waist, hands braced on my thighs, the sound rising into the cold morning air and scattering a pair of starlings from the branches above me. I laughed until my ribs hurt. I laughed until tears blurred the tree line. My name is Josie Colwyn. I am 23 years old. I am the only Omega registered in the Iron Vale Pack's border territory, and I was going to be found like this. Stuck. Laughing, smelling like creek mud and goat. The Iron Vale territory was not a gentle place to be in Omega. It sat at the northern edge of the known packlands, where the trees grew too close together and the winters came without announcement, and the wolves who lived here were the kind who had been shaped by hard ground and harder choices. I'd been assigned here 8 months ago by the Council's placement system. A bureaucratic lottery that matched unmated Omegas to territories that had formally requested support staff. Ironvale had requested a healer. They'd gotten me. I was a decent healer. I knew my plants. I knew my compounds. I knew how to set a bone and draw a fever down through the night. What I was not, what I had never been, was impressive. I was 5'4" on a generous morning, pale-haired and pale-skinned. Built like someone had assembled a person out of spare parts and then lost interest before finishing. The wolves here were large. They moved through spaces like they owned them. Which they did, technically, and they looked at me with a particular kind of patient tolerance that I recognized as the look one gives a stray that keeps showing up at the door. Not unkind. Not cruel. Just unbothered. I'd made my peace with it. I had not made peace with the mud. I tried again, a slow, deliberate upward pressure with my right leg, rotating slightly at the hip the way I'd read about in a survival text years ago. The mud released a wet, grudging sound. I gained maybe half an inch. "Progress," I told Bram encouragingly. He had begun to wander upstream. "Bram. Bram." The forest answered me instead, not with words, with silence, the specific sudden silence that falls when something large moves through trees nearby. The birds went first, then the insects, and then even the creek seemed to muffle itself, and the back of my neck prickled with a warning my body understood before my mind caught up. I turned as much as the mud would allow me. He stood at the tree line. I recognized him the way you recognize a storm on the horizon. Not from any specific detail, but from the sheer weight of his presence, the way the air around him seemed to rearrange itself in acknowledgement. Leander Voss, Alpha King of the Iron Veil Pack and four adjacent territories, which meant he was, technically, the most powerful supernatural authority in a 300-mile radius. He was wearing riding leathers, dark and worn at the edges, with the fur-lined mantle I'd seen him in once before, at a distance, during the autumn muster. He was tall enough that the low branches of the pines didn't quite reach his shoulders. His dark braids were loosely gathered back, and his eyes, pale, startlingly pale blue, like winter sky just before snow, were fixed on me with an expression I couldn't immediately classify. He looked at the mud, at me, at the goat, now inspecting something upstream with great interest. He looked back at me, and I watched, with a kind of detached fascination, as the corners of his mouth moved. Not a smile. Not quite. Something that lived just below a smile, contained and almost disbelieving, like a man who had walked out of a war council meeting and stumbled into something his entire framework of the world had not prepared him for. "Omega," he said. His voice was low, and it landed in my chest the way distant thunder does, felt, before it's fully heard. "Alpha King," I answered, politely, with as much composure as a woman buried to her knees in creek mud could reasonably project. A beat of silence. "Are you?" he said slowly. "Laughing?" I considered the question seriously. My eyes were still wet. My ribs still ached. "I was," I said. "I've moved into the acceptance phase now." Something shifted in his face, something quick and unguarded that I almost missed, like a door opening an inch and then carefully, deliberately closing again. He stepped forward. He moved through the creek bank's edge with the kind of instinctive caution that told me he'd assess the ground before committing his weight to it. One careful step onto a root system that held firm, then another onto a flat shelf of stone half-submerged at the water's edge. He didn't rush. He didn't announce what he was doing. He simply moved toward the problem with the quiet efficiency of someone who had spent a lifetime solving things without needing to explain himself first. I watched him come and tried very hard to look like I wasn't mortified. He stopped just at the edge of the mud's reach, close enough now that I could see the faint scar that ran along his jaw. An old one, silver-white against tanned skin, and the way his pale eyes moved over the situation, with that same unreadable expression, cataloging, calculating. "How long?" he asked. "Since I got stuck." He nodded once. "About 15 minutes." I paused. "Give or take the laughing." He crouched down, which brought him closer to my eye level, and studied the mud around my legs with the focused attention of a man examining a tactical problem. His braids fell forward slightly over one shoulder. Up close, he smelled like pine resin and cold air, and something darker underneath. Wood smoke, leather, something that made the Omega instinct in me go very still, and very quiet, in a way I'd learned to ignore. "You rotated," he said, noticing the slight angle of my right leg. "Survival Text, Volume 2, Chapter on Wetland Navigation." I kept my voice even. It helped a little. He glanced up at me then, just briefly, and there was something in it. Not mockery, not the tolerant amusement I was used to from the pack wolves, but something more like genuine attention, like he was actually looking at me rather than past me. "Give me your hands," he said. I did, without thinking, held them out toward him over the mud surface, and he reached across and took both of them in one of his, which should have been logistically awkward, and somehow wasn't. His grip was warm and very certain, the kind of grip that doesn't ask whether you trust it. "Don't pull against me," he said. "Let your legs go loose. When I count three, exhale and come straight up." "Straight up," I repeated, "like you're being lifted. Don't fight the suction. Move with it." I nodded. He positioned himself more firmly on the stone shelf, redistributing his weight, and I understood in that moment, how much strength it actually required to do what he was about to do without going in himself. "One," he said. I exhaled a slow breath and tried to release the tension in my thighs. "Two." The mud felt like it was weighing me down with intention. "Three." He pulled, not violently, not with a jerk, but with a steady, rising pressure that was immense and controlled, like a tide, and I let myself go loose the way he'd said. And the mud released me with a sound so aggressively undignified that I felt heat flood my face all the way to my ears. A deep, wet, sucking pop that sent a small wave across the creek surface and launched me forward enough that he had to step back and catch my weight against his chest to stop us both from pitching sideways. For a single, suspended second, I was pressed against the front of him, cold, mud-soaked wool against warm leather, my hands braced on his forearms, his arm across my back, and I felt his exhale against the top of my head. I stepped back immediately. As immediately as a woman with no boots could manage on a rock shelf above a creek. One boot was still in the mud. I looked at it. He looked at it. "I'll get it," I said quickly. "Don't step back into—" "I know. I know." I fished it out with one careful hand, which required me to crouch and plunge my arm elbow deep into the mud. And I heard—I was almost certain I heard—a sound from him. Quiet. Barely there. Almost like the beginning of a laugh that he caught and rerouted before it could become anything he'd have to acknowledge. I straightened up with the boot and looked at him. His expression was perfectly composed. I looked at my arm, coated in black mud to the elbow. "Well," I said. He said nothing, but something around his eyes had changed. A slight softening, or maybe a slight strain, the expression of a man exercising very deliberate control over his own face. We stood like that for a moment on the stone shelf above Sallow Creek. The alpha king of four territories in his riding leathers, and me, bootless and mud-coated at 7 a.m. with my goat now nowhere in sight. "Thank you," I said. "Sincerely." I had a plan, but it was not a good plan. What was the plan? Wait for the mud to dry. He was quiet for a beat too long. "That would have taken," he said carefully, "most of the day." "I know." I wrung mud from my sleeve. "It was not a good plan. I said that." This time I saw it. A brief, involuntary twitch at the corner of his mouth that he pressed flat almost immediately, but not quite fast enough. It was there and then gone, but I'd seen it, and it left me oddly warm in a way that had nothing to do with the morning sun finally cresting the tree line. Leander Voss was not known for humor. He was not known for warmth, particularly. He was known for being the alpha who had ended the Eastern Border War in a single winter, for running his territories with a precision that other alphas studied and resented in equal measure, for speaking rarely, and meaning everything he said. The pack wolves here respected him the way old forests respect storms. Not from affection, but from a deep structural understanding that some forces simply are what they are. He had never, to my knowledge, been seen nearly laughing in a creek bed over a stuck Omega and her escaped goat. He cleared his throat, looked out at the water. "Were you assigned the Eastern Healing Post?" "Yes, 8 months ago. "Colwyn?" "Yes." It still surprised me slightly when people here knew my name. I'd spent 8 months mostly feeling like furniture. Useful, occasionally, but not particularly noticed. "You treated Fennec's shoulder," he said. It wasn't a question. Fennec was one of his senior patrol wolves, a large, taciturn man who'd come to me 6 weeks ago with a rotator tear he'd been ignoring for 2 months. I'd spent 3 sessions on it. "He waited too long," I said. "But it's healing cleanly now." "He said you didn't make him feel foolish for waiting." I blinked. "Why would I do that?" He looked back at me then, and this time the attention was fully direct, unhidden, and something in it made my pulse do something I pretended not to notice. "Most people would have," he said simply. Before I could respond, a sound came from upstream, a crash of underbrush, and then a very familiar maa. And Bram reappeared around the creek bend, trotting toward us with the self-satisfied energy of an animal who had briefly become a free spirit and was now willing to rejoin society on his own terms. He stopped in front of Leander and sniffed his boot. Leander looked down at the goat. "That's Bram," I offered. "I know." A pause. "He was in the Eastern grain stores last month." "I know. I'm sorry. He's very... determined," Leander said. I was going to say difficult. "Those are often the same thing." He said it quietly, almost to himself, and he was looking at the goat, but something in the line of it felt like it landed somewhere else. He straightened, pulling his mantle back into place, and the moment shifted, became more formal, the way air changes when a door closes. He was the Alpha King again, fully assembled, and I was the muddy Omega from the Eastern Post, and the world between us rearranged itself back into its proper distances. "The patrol circuit runs near your post on Thursdays," he said. "If the goat continues to be a problem, send word." "I'll do that." I paused. "Thank you again. Truly." He nodded once, the clean, contained kind of acknowledgement that was apparently the Leander Voss equivalent of a lengthy speech, and then he turned and walked back along the stone shelf toward the tree line. I watched him go. He was 10 feet into the trees when he stopped. Didn't turn around. "Colwyn." "Yes?" "Next time," he said. "Don't wait for the mud to dry." And then he was gone, swallowed by the pines, and I was left standing one-booted and mud-covered at the edge of Sallow Creek, with my goat pressing his forehead against my hip, and my heart doing something slow and complicated in my chest that I very firmly decided not to think about. I looked down at Bram. "Not a word," I told him. He looked deeply unbothered. I didn't tell anyone about the creek, not because I was ashamed, well, not only because I was ashamed, but because the Eastern Healing Post wasn't exactly overflowing with people who asked about my mornings. My closest neighbor was Petra, a mated beta female who ran the supply depot 2 clearings over and who communicated primarily through meaningful silences and the occasional bowl of stew left on my doorstep. She was kind in a way that didn't require words, and I appreciated her for it. But we were not the kind of friends who sat down over tea and exchanged stories about encounters with the Alpha King at 7 in the morning. So I kept it to myself. I cleaned the mud off in the creek's shallower edge, freezing and efficient about it, then walked back to the post with Bram in tow, made a fire, and sat in front of it for a long time, pretending to review my herb inventory, while actually doing nothing of the sort. "Don't wait for the mud to dry." It was such a small thing to say. Practical, even. Logistically sound advice. There was absolutely no reason for it to sit in the back of my mind with the particular weight it had taken on, warm and slightly inconvenient, like an ember that wouldn't go cold. I told myself it meant nothing. I was reasonably convincing. The following Thursday, I heard the patrol before I saw it. The Eastern Post sat at the edge of the tree line where the forest thinned toward open meadow, and sound carried differently there. Hoofbeats arrived before their riders did, and voices came through the morning air in fragments before assembling into whole sentences. I was outside grinding dried yarrow when I heard the low rumble of conversation and the creak of leather and the specific cadence of a group moving with military ease through familiar terrain. I kept grinding. There were 4 of them. I recognized 2. Fennec, broad-shouldered and still slightly favoring his right arm in a way I made a mental note about, and a younger wolf named Kale, who'd come to me once for a bad reaction to a wasp sting and had been mildly embarrassed about it ever since. The other 2 I knew by sight, but not by name. A woman with close-cropped dark hair and the kind of jaw that suggested she'd won most of her arguments physically, and a very large, very quiet man whose face I had never once seen express an emotion. And behind them, slightly apart in the way that authority always creates its own distance, was Leander. He was on horseback today, a dark gray horse that suited him in ways I chose not to examine. And he was speaking to Fennec in a low voice when the group came to the natural pause that trails naturally produce at the edge of someone's working space. I looked up. Our eyes met. He gave me the same contained nod he'd given me at the creek. I gave him one back. Fennec spotted me and raised his chin in greeting. Colwyn, how's the yarrow crop?
Adequate, I said. How's the shoulder?
He rolled it, testing.
Better than it deserves to be.
You're still compensating on the right side when you ride, I said.
I can see it from here.
Come by tomorrow morning, and I'll show you a stretch that'll help. He looked briefly like a man who wanted to argue, and then thought better of it.
Fine.
The woman with the jaw looked at me with a new quality of attention. Not hostile, just recalibrating, the way people do when they realize the furniture has opinions.
You can see that from here?
I grew up watching my father ride, I said. He had the same problem after a fall. It becomes habit if you don't correct it early. The woman glanced at Leander with an expression I couldn't quite read. He was watching me with that same steady, unhurried attention he'd had at the creek, but said nothing.
I'm Sable, the woman said.
Senior Patrol Lieutenant.
Josie,
I said. The Omega from the Eastern Post.
I know who you are.
She said it without unkindness.
Fennec hasn't stopped talking about that shoulder for a month.
I did not, Fennec began.
You absolutely did, said Kale cheerfully, which earned him a look that could have stripped bark from a tree.
The large, silent man said nothing, which I was beginning to understand was simply his natural state. Leander dismounted. It was a smooth, unhurried movement, one hand on the pommel, weight shifting, boots settling onto the ground without drama. And I was absolutely not watching it with any particular attention. He handed his reins to Kale and walked toward the post's edge, stopping a few feet from where I was working, and looked at the spread of herbs drying on the wooden rack beside me with the same serious focus he seemed to give everything.
Yarrow, he said.
Yarrow, elderflower, and some late-season boneset, I confirmed. I'm low on boneset. The stand near the northern ridge is the best one I've found, but it's past the patrol boundary.
How far past?
Half a mile, maybe less. Just over the second rise.
He was quiet for a moment.
I'll have Kale mark it as an approved foraging site.
I blinked.
You don't have to.
You need it for the healing stores.
He said it simply, like it was a logical conclusion rather than a concession, and somehow that made it harder to push back against than if it had been generosity. It was just reason, clear and direct.
Thank you, I said.
He nodded. Then, instead of returning to his horse, he crouched beside the drying rack and looked at the bone set more closely.
My mother used this, he said, almost to himself.
The observation was quiet enough that I wasn't sure he'd meant to say it aloud. I waited, not filling the silence the way I sometimes felt the urge to.
She kept a garden, he said after a moment.
Outside the war hall. Everyone thought it was decorative. The corner of his mouth shifted slightly.
It wasn't, and it never is, I said.
Most healers hide what they do in plain sight. It's practical. He looked up at me from his crouch, and the angle put his face in the full morning light. And I saw for the first time how tired he looked under the composure. Not dramatically tired, not the kind you complain about, the settled, load-bearing kind, the kind that comes from years of carrying weight in silence and simply growing the musculature for it.
I recognized that kind. I'd seen it in the mirror.
She would have approved of your inventory, he said, standing.
It was such a careful compliment.
Not about me, not quite. But adjacent to me, offered from behind something guarded and real. And it landed differently than compliments usually did.
That might be the nicest thing anyone said to me since I arrived here, I told him honestly. Something moved across his face. That says more about this pack than it does about you. Before I could respond to that, before I could even decide how to respond to that, Sable called from the path. Leander, the ridge trail won't stay clear past midday. He straightened fully, and the Alpha King reassembled himself around whatever had briefly surfaced. I'll have the foraging clearance sent to you by end of week, he said. His tone returned to its formal register. I appreciate it. He held my gaze for one beat longer than necessary. Just one, just enough that I felt it. And then turned and walked back to his horse. Kale fell into step beside me as the group prepared to move, his voice pitched low and carrying the conspiratorial energy of someone who enjoyed information. For what it's worth, he murmured. He never dismounts during patrol checks. I looked at him. He raised his eyebrows meaningfully and then jogged back to his horse before I could respond. I stood at the edge of my clearing and watched the patrol move back into the trees. Sable sharp and precise at the front, Fennec broad and steady, the silent large man like a shadow, Kale with his barely suppressed energy, and Leander last, as befitted someone whose presence made everything else organize itself around him. He didn't look back. I hadn't expected him to, but I stood there longer than I needed to, after the tree line swallowed the last sound of hoofbeats. With the yarrow half ground in my bowl, and the morning light settling long and gold across the meadow. And I thought about a man who had learned to carry weight silently for so long that he'd forgotten anyone might notice, and about a healer who had spent 8 months being furniture, and about the strange, specific feeling of being seen by someone who seemed to look at the world with the same carefulness they looked at everything else. Bram headbutted my knee. I know, I told him. I went inside and made tea, and sat with both hands around the warm cup for a long time, listening to the forest settle back into its ordinary sounds, trying very hard not to think about pale blue eyes in morning light. I was not entirely successful. 3 weeks passed. The foraging clearance arrived on a Tuesday, delivered by Kale, who handed it to me with the specific expression of someone trying very hard not to comment on something. It was a formal document, pack seal in dark wax, the boundary adjustments written in clean official script, and at the bottom, in different handwriting, slightly less formal, were the words, "The boneset stand near the second rise has been marked. There is also a stand of late Valyrian on the eastern slope that may be useful." L. I read it twice. Then I set it on my workbench and looked at it for an unreasonably long time. Kale, who had not left, watched me do this. So, he said. Thank you for delivering this, I said. That's all you've got? That's all I've got, Kale. He left with the expression of a man deeply unsatisfied with the narrative he'd been offered, and I went back to work and was extremely productive for the rest of the day, which I attributed entirely to good discipline and not at all to the particular energized quality that had settled into my chest. Like sunlight through a window. I found the Valyrian stand that Thursday. It was exactly where the note indicated. Eastern slope, sheltered by a limestone outcrop that caught the afternoon warmth and created a microclimate just temperate enough for late-season growth. It was a better stand than anything I'd found in 8 months of foraging, and it would supply the post through winter and beyond. I stood in the middle of it with my harvesting basket, and the low autumn sun on my back, and I thought about someone who had ridden out specifically enough to notice what grew on a slope, and told me about it, and I felt something inside my chest do a slow, complicated turn that I no longer had the energy to pretend wasn't happening. The first real cold came in the second week of November. It arrived without the usual warning. No gradual cooling. No frost on the grass foreplay. Just one morning where the sky was white from edge to edge, and the air had a bite that went straight through wool. The creek froze at its edges overnight. Bram refused to leave the pen without being bribed with grain. I was inside working on a fever compound when I heard footsteps on the post path, heavier than Petra. more deliberate than Kale, and looked up to find Fennec filling my doorway like a piece of architecture that had decided to become mobile. "The Alpha King wants you at the hall," he said. I set down my pestle. "Is someone hurt?"
"Pack meeting."
He paused. "You've been formally summoned." I had never been formally summoned to anything. The Ironvale Hall sat at the center of the pack's main settlement, 3 miles northwest of my post, and I had been inside it exactly once, briefly, during my initial placement review, and had found it exactly as intimidating as a room designed to project the authority of a lineage of Alpha Kings for 300 years ought to be. Stone floors, high raftered ceiling, the kind of fireplace that could comfortably fit 4 people standing, maps on every wall, the weight of decisions in the air. I rode Petra's borrowed horse through the cold morning with my cloak pulled tight and Fennec slightly ahead, his broad back blocking some of the wind, and I spent the 3 miles trying to construct a reasonable explanation for why an Omega healer from the Eastern Post had been formally summoned to a pack meeting. I could not construct one. The hall was full when we arrived. Not chaotically full. Pack wolves didn't mill about. They arranged themselves with the unconscious hierarchy of people who had been raised to know exactly where they stood. Senior patrol along the left wall, Sable at their front. Den mothers and settlement leads along the right. Unmated wolves toward the back. A handful of faces I recognized, and a larger number I didn't. Leander stood at the head of the room in front of the great map table, and he was in full alpha regalia. The formal mantle, the harness, the bearing that turned a room into his room simply by existing in it. And he was in conversation with 2 men I didn't know, both older, both carrying the specific tension of people who disagreed with something and hadn't finished disagreeing yet. Sable appeared at my elbow. "Council representatives," she murmured. "From the Southern Territories. They arrived yesterday." "What do they want?" "To remind us that we exist within a larger political structure," she said flatly, "as they do every quarter." I found a place near the back wall, not wanting to draw attention, and watched. The meeting opened formally, the way all pack business did. Acknowledgement of territory, acknowledgement of lineage, the ritual phrases that I had learned the shape of, even if I'd never participated in them. Leander moved through it with the practiced ease of someone who had presided over these rituals since he was young, his voice carrying without effort, filling the high-ceilinged room without strain. Then the taller of the 2 council representatives stepped forward. His name, I would learn later, was Aldrich, a senior mediator from the Southern Reach, silvered at the temples and carrying himself with the particular authority of a man who had never had it questioned. He spoke about resource allocation, about territory assessments, about the formal evaluation process for border settlements. Standard political language, dense and procedural. And then, almost as an aside, "The Council has concerns about the sustainability of the Eastern Post's current resource arrangements. Specifically, the recent boundary modification for foraging access." He paused. "Modifications of that nature require formal council review before implementation." The room changed temperature. Not dramatically, but I felt it. A slight tightening, a collective attention refocusing. Leander's expression didn't change. The modification was within the Alpha's discretionary authority for settlement support. It required no external review. "For established settlements, yes. For a temporary placement, the Eastern Post is not designated temporary. The Omega assigned to it is a placement, not a permanent resident. The distinction is relevant to resource classification." Aldrich's tone remained measured, bureaucratic. "The Council's position is that individual accommodations for unbound Omegas shouldn't be processed through territorial modification. It sets precedent." Silence. I became extremely aware of how close the back wall was, and how much I wished I could simply become part of it. Sable, beside me, had gone very still. Leander looked at Aldrich for a moment, that stretched long enough to be deliberate. "The Eastern Post serves the pack's medical needs," he said. "The healer assigned to it requires access to adequate foraging ground to fulfill that function. Restricting that access impairs pack welfare. The modification stands." Aldrich smiled the smile of a man who had anticipated this. "Then the council will require a formal welfare assessment, conducted by an independent reviewer, before it can be approved retroactively. Standard procedure for disputed modifications." He glanced, briefly, professionally, toward the back wall, toward me. "I assume the healer in question is present. Every eye in the room found me. I stood very still. I had spent 8 months being furniture. I was extremely good at being unobtrusive. And yet I was suddenly, comprehensively visible in a way that made my pulse climb and my hands want to do something with themselves." "She is," Leander said. His voice hadn't changed. Nothing about him had changed. "Then perhaps she can speak to the necessity herself." Aldrich turned toward me fully, with the patient expression of a man who did not expect a compelling argument. "What is your professional assessment of the modification's necessity, Omega?" I understood what was happening. I was not politically naive. I had grown up in a pack. I had watched power move through rooms. I knew a stage diminishment when I saw one. Aldrich didn't need my assessment. He wanted to demonstrate, in front of the room, that the Alpha King had extended resources to an unimportant outsider on insufficient grounds. He wanted to make the modification look like sentiment dressed as policy. I looked at Leander. He was watching me, and his expression was, for just a moment, not quite composed. There was something underneath it, something that looked almost like a warning, or an apology, or both. Like a man who had not anticipated this particular move and was recalculating in real time. I looked back at Aldrich, and something in me went very quiet and very clear. The Eastern Post's medical inventory was running a 30% deficit in bone set and valerian coming into winter, I said. My voice was even. I was grateful for that. Both compounds are primary components in the fever protocols we use for pups and elderly pack members. The nearest alternative foraging sites are 4 miles outside the established post radius, which in winter conditions, particularly with this season's early freeze, becomes a logistical problem that directly impacts response time in medical emergencies. The modification brings 2 known high-yield stands within accessible range and closes the deficit entirely. I paused. If the Council's concern is precedent, I can provide written documentation of the medical rationale for independent review. I'd be happy to do that. Silence. Not the tight, charged kind. A different kind. The kind where a room absorbs something it hadn't expected. Aldrich blinked once, just once. "That would be acceptable," he said, in a tone that had lost some of its bureaucratic smoothness. "I'll have it ready by morning," I said. Sable made a very small sound beside me that might, in another context, have been a laugh. The meeting continued. More procedural matters, more territorial review, the back and forth of pack politics moving through its established channels. I stayed at the back wall and kept my hands still and my expression neutral, and tried not to think about the way Leander had looked at me in the moment before I spoke. Afterward, when the room was breaking apart into smaller conversations, Sable appeared at my side again. "Where did that come from?" she asked. "I know my inventory," I said. "You know more than your inventory." She studied me for a moment. "You knew what he was doing. I've been in rooms like this before, smaller rooms." I paused. "The tactics don't really change with the size." She looked at me with an expression that had shed most of its earlier neutrality, replaced by something more direct, more evaluative. "You've been here 8 months, and I don't know anything about you. I'm not very interesting." "That," she said, "is the most unconvincing thing you've said since I met you." I was still processing that when I felt the shift in the room's attention, subtle, directional, the way iron filings reorient near a magnet, and looked up to find Leander moving through the thinning crowd toward me. The council representatives were deep in conversation near the map table, not watching. Fennec and the silent large man, whose name I had finally learned was Doran, were near the door. He stopped in front of me, close enough for a private conversation, far enough for propriety, or whatever passed for it here. "That was well handled," he said quietly. "I just told the truth," I said. "Most people find that harder than they expect in rooms like this." I looked up at him. The formal bearing was still present. It was always present. I was beginning to understand it as structural rather than performative, the way a load-bearing wall looks like decoration, but is actually holding up the roof. But there was something underneath it tonight that felt more worn than usual. The tiredness I'd seen before, amplified. "He was going to make you look like you'd made a sentimental decision," I said. Something shifted in his jaw. "Yes." "Had you?" I asked. And then immediately, "You don't have to answer that." He was quiet for a long moment, looking at me with that full, unhurried attention. Around us, the hall was filling with the sounds of departure, voices and movement, and the creak of the great door opening to let in cold air. "I knew you needed the foraging ground," he said carefully. "But..." A beat. I also knew about the Valyrian stand, because I'd ridden that slope twice in the same week and found myself looking for reasons to note it. I was very glad I had learned. Over 23 years, to keep my expression composed. "That's an honest answer," I said. "You asked an honest question." The fire in the great hearth was burning low, and in the amber light he looked less like an institution and more like a person, tired and certain and carrying something large, and for the first time since I'd come to Ironvale, I felt the specific weight of my own loneliness. How thoroughly I'd packed it away and called it adaptation. "The documentation will genuinely be ready by morning," I said. "It's not a problem. The rationale is sound." "I know it is." He paused. "That's not why I'm standing here." The honesty of it landed like the first warmth after cold, quiet and spreading and impossible to fully prepare for. From across the room, Doran caught Leander's eye and gave a very small nod toward the door. The council representatives were preparing to leave. The Alpha King was needed. Leander looked at me for one more moment. "Colwyn." "Josie," I said, without quite meaning to. Something in his face did something I didn't have a name for yet. "Josie," he said quietly, like he was testing the weight of it. Like it was the first time a name had meant anything specific in a long time. Then he turned and straightened and walked back into the room he was built to command. And I stood alone in the amber firelight with my cloak still on, and my heart doing something slow and entirely unmanageable. And across the room, Kale caught my eye and gave me a look of profound and theatrical significance that I chose to completely ignore. I walked home through the first real dark of winter, the cold clean and sharp around me, the trees black against a sky full of hard, bright stars. And I thought about the fact that he'd ridden that slope twice in 1 week. I thought about it the whole way home. Winter settled over Ironvale the way it always did in the north. Not gradually, not with apology, but with the absolute finality of a door closing. The creek froze solid by the second week of December. The meadow outside my post disappeared under snow that came to my knees, and the mornings became a particular shade of blue-white silence that felt less like absence and more like the world holding its breath. I submitted the documentation to the council representative the morning after the hall meeting, as promised. It was thorough. 12 pages of medical inventory records, foraging radius calculations, winter protocol references, and a clear clinical argument for why the boundary modification was not a sentimental gesture, but a functional necessity. I had been up before dawn writing it, not from anxiety, but from something closer to purpose. The particular focused energy that comes when you finally understand what you're actually doing and why it matters. Aldrich received it without comment. He left Ironvale 2 days later. The modification stood. Sable told me about it in passing, appearing at my door on a gray Thursday morning with the news and a container of something that turned out to be venison stew, which he handed to me without explanation or preamble. "The council filed it as approved," she said. "Good," I said. She looked at me, then at the stew she'd just handed over, then back at me. "You're not going to make a big thing of this, are you?" "Should I?" "Most people would." "I wrote a report," I said. "It wasn't heroic." Sable leaned against my doorframe and studied me with the expression I was coming to recognize as her version of warmth. Direct, appraising, stripped of any softness that might be mistaken for weakness. "Fennec said you were quiet," she said. "He didn't say you were like this."
"Like what?"
"Settled," she said. Like the word surprised her slightly as she chose it. I didn't know what to do with that, so I invited her in for tea, and she stayed for 2 hours. And somewhere in the middle of it, she told me about growing up in the Southern Territories, about leaving at 17, about the decade it had taken to earn her place in Ironvale's patrol structure. She told it plainly, without drama, the way people who have genuinely processed difficult things tend to tell their stories. I listened, and I told her a little about my own path, the small pack I'd grown up in, the decision to enter the placement system, the particular challenge of being an Omega in a world that had very fixed ideas about what Omegas were for. "And yet you're here," she said. "And yet I'm here," I agreed. She left with the empty stew container and a nod that felt like more than a nod, and I stood in my doorway and watched her cross the snow-covered clearing and thought that I had, apparently, made a friend. I wasn't entirely sure when it had happened. Leander came to the post on a Wednesday. Not with the patrol, alone, on foot, which meant he'd walked the 3 miles from the main settlement through snow that had come up fresh overnight. I heard his approach from inside, recognized the cadence of it, and had a moment of completely irrational panic, during which I knocked my elbow into the yarrow jar and had to spend 30 seconds collecting dried herb from the workbench while talking myself down from something I refused to name. I opened the door before he knocked. He stood on the post step in his heavy traveling cloak, snow on his shoulders and his braids, and he was carrying something, a wrapped package, rough cloth, tied with cord. He looked at the open door and then at me with an expression that was fractionally less composed than usual, which I had come to understand meant something. "I didn't send word," he said. "No," I agreed. "I should have." "Probably." I stepped back from the door. "Come in." He came in, which immediately made the post feel different. Not smaller, exactly, but more inhabited, the way a room changes when it contains something significant. He looked around the space with the same careful attention he gave everything. The drying racks, the workbench, the shelves of labeled compounds, the small fire, Bram visible through the back window standing in his pen looking deeply put upon by the snow. He set the package on the workbench. "I had the winter store's inventory completed last week," he said. "We had a surplus of rendered tallow. It's useful for salve bases." I looked at the package. "That's a very clinical way to deliver something." Something shifted in his jaw. "I'm aware. You could have sent it with Kale." "I could have." I looked up at him. "Why didn't you?" The fire crackled. Outside, the snow was coming down again in the fine, dry way that meant it would keep coming for hours. Leander stood in the middle of my small post, looking like a man who had made a decision and was now reckoning with the particular exposure that decisions create. "Because I wanted to come myself," he said, simply, directly, in the same tone he used for tactical assessments and territorial policy, which somehow made it more honest than if he'd dressed it in anything softer. I was quiet for a moment. "I've been trying to be careful," he said then, his voice lower. something moving in it that he wasn't fully keeping back. There are reasons to be careful. My position, your placement status, the politics of what Aldrich was already trying to make of a foraging boundary. He paused. I'm aware of the complications. So am I, I said. And? I looked at him. Really looked. The way I had learned to look at the pack wolves here. Reading what lived underneath the surface performance. I saw the tiredness I'd noticed months ago. Still there. Still load-bearing. I saw the careful control that was structural rather than cold. I saw, underneath all of it, something that looked recognizably like what I felt when I stood in the Valerian stand on the eastern slope and thought about a man who had ridden that way twice in a week. I got stuck in creek mud in November, I said. And instead of being embarrassed about it, I laughed. And you nearly laughed too, and then spent the next 3 months finding careful reasons to come back. I paused. I don't think either of us is particularly good at being indifferent to things. The corner of his mouth moved. That same almost smile I'd been cataloging since the beginning, each instance stored somewhere I didn't examine too closely. No, he said. We're not. He crossed the space between us in two steps, not rushing, not hesitating, just moving with the same direct certainty he brought to everything, and stopped close enough that I had to look up to meet his eyes, and they were that winter sky blue, and this close they weren't cold at all. He raised one hand and tucked a strand of my pale hair back from my face, carefully, like someone handling something they didn't want to damage. I'd like to court you properly, he said, within whatever complications exist, if you're willing. I thought about 8 months of being furniture, about foraging clearances and Valerian stands and documentation written before dawn, about a man who had nearly laughed in a creek bed and then carried that moment quietly for weeks. I'm willing, I said. What followed was not simple. I want to be honest about that, because simple would be a lie, and this story has too much truth in it to end with one. The council raised objections twice more over the winter. Procedural ones, political ones, the machinery of bureaucracy grinding against something it didn't have a category for. Aldrich sent letters. There were formal reviews. Sable attended two of them as a character witness and delivered testimony so precise and unsparing that Kale told me afterward he had genuinely been a little afraid of her, which coming from Kale meant something. Fennec, for his part, told anyone who would listen that his shoulder had never been better, and managed to work this into conversations that had nothing to do with medical care with impressive dedication. Doran, the large, silent man whose face I had never seen express an emotion, came to my post in January with a pulled muscle in his lower back, and while I worked on it, said approximately 4 words total, but left with something that might, on a very generous interpretation, have been a smile. He came back the following week, and the week after. I began to suspect the muscle had healed much faster than he was letting on, but I didn't say so, and he kept coming. And by February he had spoken nearly 12 full sentences to me, which Kale informed me was a pack record. These people became mine. Not in any formal sense, not yet, and not without the work that belonging always requires, but in the quieter sense. The daily sense. The sense of a life gradually becoming legible in a new place. Leander courted me the way he did everything. With patience. With directness. With small gestures that were never accidental. He came to the post on Wednesday afternoons when his schedule allowed, and sometimes we talked for hours, and sometimes we walked the tree line in silence, and both of those things were the same quality of good. He told me about his mother's garden in pieces, not all at once. I told him about my father's horses in pieces, too. We assembled each other slowly, the way you do when you understand that the assembling is the point. In March, when the first thaw came and the creek began to move again, he walked with me to Sallow Creek. My suggestion, which made his expression do that complicated thing it did sometimes. And we stood on the stone shelf where he'd pulled me free, and the mud had thawed back to its treacherous softness. And he looked at it with the expression of a man remembering something, and I looked at it with the expression of a woman who no longer found the memory embarrassing. "You were laughing," he said. "I was stuck," I said. "What else was there to do?" He looked at me. "That was the moment," he said quietly. "I want you to know that. Standing there watching you laugh at something that would have humiliated anyone else, that was the moment." I felt the truth of it settle into me, warm and permanent, the way things do when they find the place they were always meant to go. "You fell in love with me before you pulled me out," I said. He didn't look away. "Yes. That is a deeply inconvenient origin story for an Alpha King." "Yes," he said again. And this time the smile came all the way, full, unguarded, utterly real, changing his whole face into something I felt the privilege of seeing. And I laughed, and he pulled me in by the waist, and there at the edge of the creek where the mud had claimed me, and released me and started everything. I was kissed for the first time by a man who had decided I was worth the complications before I was even free. I am telling you this from the Great Hall, which is mine now in a way that still startles me some mornings. The maps are still on the walls. The fireplace is still large enough for 4 people standing, but there is a workbench in the east alcove where the old weapons display used to be, and the shelves beside it hold labeled compounds and dried herbs and a very particular inventory system that Sable has called aggressively organized on more than one occasion. Bram lives in the settlement paddock. He has escaped twice this year. Leander pretends to be annoyed about this and is not. Petra brought stew to the hall last winter, set it on the great table without a word, nodded at me, and left. I consider this the highest honor I have received in my life here. Fennec's shoulder is perfect. He mentions this constantly. Doran came to the infirmary last month with what he claimed was a recurring tension headache, spent an hour sitting in comfortable silence, and left looking measurably better. I have stopped questioning the mechanism by which this works. Kale, who told me Leander never dismounts during patrol checks, attended our bonding ceremony with the expression of someone who had always known how the story would end and was deeply satisfied to have been right. I told him this afterward. He didn't deny it. And Leander, my complicated, careful, load-bearing man, still walks the eastern slope sometimes in the early mornings, still looks at what grows there with the attention of someone who learned to pay attention from a woman who kept a garden outside a war hall and called it decorative. He told me once, quietly, that he thinks she would have liked me. I think about that on the hard days, when the politics are grinding, and the winters are long, and the weight of this life is more than I remembered signing up for. I think about it, and it holds. This is not a story about a woman who was rescued from the mud. The mud released me. He was just there when it did. But what came after? The foraging clearances, and the hall meetings, and the Wednesday afternoons, and the slow, deliberate construction of a life built on honesty and valerian stands, and a man who learned to let his smile come all the way, that was built by both of us, together, on ground we chose to stand on. Some ground holds. This kind does. That is how I know it's real. That is how I know it's done. We are still here.